Might have a little lag here. These were some of the cinematics that I did for Pharaoh. Again for Pharaoh. And this was 1999, so this is when, you know, this was the first time we were really on the desktop getting into stuff like fluid dynamic simulations and that sort of thing with the water. Also interspersed in here, you're going to see some of the Lords of the Realm 3 cinematics. We used a different technique on that. The technique is called camera mapping. And basically camera mapping, what it is that you project the texture coordinates from the camera onto the geometry. The limitations of that are that you can't do a 360 revolution of the camera because the texture coordinates are generated from the position of the camera. But you can get some really nice painterly effects. And if you look at these here, these were all done with the camera mapping technique, and you can see how much more painterly they look than just a straight 3D render. I was cranking on Pharaoh too. I cranked out 6 minutes worth of video in the last 2 months of the project, and I was essentially working alone. On the first 3 minutes of the cinematics, we had a group of probably three or four artists creating all the props and some of the stage sets and whatnot. And then I would take them and I would light them. I would, I'd block the shots. I'd do the storyboards and animatics, and I would do, you know, basically everything from there, all the character animation. Now, unfortunately, our sound is about a minute and a half ahead of the video, so. This was, again, a scene for Pharaoh. And what we wanted to really convey here is the epicness of the space. We actually exaggerated the size of the monuments. You know, the Sphinx itself is probably only 90 to 120 feet tall. That Sphinx there is probably 350 feet. But we wanted to really convey the sense of splendor and grandeur to the user of, you know, how great the Egyptian civilization was. Now, the other thing is that, you know, I've worked on a lot of historical city builders and that sort of thing, and what I really find engaging and intriguing about them is that you learn a lot. You know, if you're on a project like this for 10 to 14 months, I mean, you learn a lot about the Roman civilization or the Egyptian civilization. You're so immersed in it, and it really comes just from the research of the art. You know, what type of pottery did they use? How do they cook? What were their houses like? You know, it's just kind of cool to, you know, to after you get out of school to have a job where you can actually learn and make cool stuff, you know. I must say, though, on the Pharaoh cinematics that the Prince of Egypt was a big influence. Some of the color palettes from the Prince of Egypt and, that was DreamWorks' first movie, and I just thought it was beautiful. Is that it? What is it, page down? Okay. Sure. No, that's fine. What do you got?
How is working on the cutscene different than working on the game animations?
Well, there are some major differences, but what we always strove to do was to create all of the art at one game scale. So any in-game assets that we had, we would create them at the same scale of the cinematics, ideally. I mean, we did run into some technical problems with that. But, what you want to do is, to whatever extent possible, is utilize your in-game assets to populate your cinematics. But the biggest difference is that, you know, your game art is being executed at runtime, so it needs to be a lot more lean. Your pre-rendered cinematics are, you know, you can do a lot more with effects and, you know, post-processing, you know, compositing, like that sort of thing.
And you think cinematics are kind of on the way out or not?
I think to some extent they are because, You know, the pre-rendered cinematics, maybe. You know, I could see them being used as marketing trailer and whatnot, but there are a lot more people doing, doing them right in the game engine. Because the game engine now is fully 3D, and it also supports enough sophisticated techniques that you can actually get some pretty good-looking, decent, 3D cutscenes via, like, camera scripting and that sort of thing. I'll always have a fondness in my heart, though, for the pre-rendered, 2D cinematics, so... All right, let's talk a little bit about the gaming industry. The good of the gaming industry is that it is cool. It's a cool industry to work in. And the reason that I say that is that I'm kind of a creative individual. I'm really into creative problem solving. I like the logic side of figuring out problems. And I also like to be creative. Now, the thing is that... The thing is that what's cool about it is that every day you go to work, you have a chance to make something a little bit cooler. So basically what you're doing is you're kind of bringing this Frankenstein to life. Depending on what size team you're on, I've worked on teams that are 8 people, I've worked on teams that are 40 people, I've worked on teams that are 60 people. It's a collective effort to make this thing organic, this organic thing cool. And, from 1 to 40 on the team, if you took a design doc and you had 40 people build something in England, and then you took the same design doc and you had 40 people build something in California, you get 2 totally different projects. Now, the thing is that the reason for that is that every person on the team, 1 to 40, brings their own personality and experiences to the project. They're going to tweak it a little bit. They're going to make something a little bit different. Now, I really like that team structure, and I really like the fact that that it's what motivates me. I can go to work and I can make something blow up today, or when we got the lightning in Caesar 4, we got lightning and weather in for the first time, but we put in a cheat where we could summon the lightning on command. So I spent a couple hours like frying all the people walking around the city. It's kind of a double-edged sword though. If you're really passionate about your job and you really love it, a lot of times you tend to work too hard. The reality of the gaming industry is that it's demanding. I mean, you got to be on top of your tech. You got to stay with your tech chops. You got to be motivated to learn. And, it's just that, you need to be ready to execute. There will be times when you'll be asked to move mountains. And that means that, maybe something was overlooked in the design, and you got to bang something out in 2 weeks, and you got to get it done. I think as an artist, what you have to understand is that when you're working in a studio as a professional, you're on their time, and producing is paramount to getting the project out the door. And it's important that you see and look at the overall scope of the project. And understand how your little piece fits into the project, because if you want to make something cool, then you can make that on your own time. But the end goal is that you want to make something that's going to fit into the scope of the project as it's defined. The not so good is you're a rock star. I mean, you guys might be like, well, that sounds pretty cool, but. The idea is that a lot of times when you go into these studios, and I've worked for big studios and small studios, and I've also worked for studios that have been downsized. And when I say you're a rock star, what I mean by that is that you're only as good as your last hit. And I've seen a lot of successful studios that, they release a bad game or two and they're done. On the flip side of that, if you create a game that is great, it could propel your studio into the stratosphere. All right, let's take a look at what the industry wants. As an art director, over the last 6 years, I probably hired about 20 different artists, and I've looked at over 100 resumes. And what I look for in individuals that are coming into the industries, self-starters. You know, I want people that have an appetite to learn. I want people that want to keep current on their tech skills. And I want people that are team players. Now, a team player is an important thing because if you're a prima donna and you're going to be difficult to work with, you better have some serious chops. And what I say by a team player is, you know, throughout my career, is that if you have an issue with something that's going on, you know, in the team, or you think the direction of the art isn't quite right, you bring it to your art director's attention. And, you know, bringing it to his attention and having a nice discussion with it is what you want to do. Like, if I think something's wrong with a project, I always speak up. I let them know how I feel about it. But you need to realize, you know, that you've made your case, and if it's not going to change, it's not going to change. So there's no point in throwing a hissy fit or, going head to head with your art director, because you know at the end of the day it's his skin on the line. He's making the final calls. He's in charge of the art budgets. So what I always say is you want to challenge them, but then also back away and try to look at the big picture and take one for the team. We also need creative problem solvers. Creative problem solvers are people that, they can take an idea, figure it out. You know, a lot of times what you have to do in the gaming industry is you need to, A lot of times in the gaming industry what you need to do is invent systems. And these systems don't exist yet. For instance, Children of the Nile, we invented a system where we could programmatically build walls when a user placed a house. Now, the house could be any shape or size, and the program would adapt the shape of the house to a template and then build the walls so it looked like the actual building was being constructed. But, a lot of times, when you're creating something like that or speccing out a system like that, there's just no blueprint for it because something like that doesn't exist yet. You want to think outside the box and try to come up with ways of achieving a good look in the game. Now, the more that you know about the tech side of things, the more that you know about programming, just by talking with programmers and having conversations with them, the more valuable you'll be in a role of being a creative problem solving or speccing graphic systems. Because you have some understanding of how the programmers are going to execute these. In addition, we're also looking for tech-savvy individuals and, quality craftsmen or crafts ladies. We're looking for people that that care about what they do, you know. And, you know, if you're coming out of art school and an art director is reviewing your portfolio, I was saying to some of the guys earlier that if you have stuff that's marginal in there, don't put it in. Because the thing is what that says to an art director is, an art director looks at a portfolio, and if you've put in pieces just to fill out the portfolio, if they say a piece that maybe there's not some understanding of how the art should be executed, or you have colors that are clashing, or it's not, your best work, then the art director looks at that and says, you don't fully understand how to produce game art. So less is less higher quality pieces in your portfolio is better than having a lot of pieces. The state of the tools, what's hot? I'm sure you guys are familiar with all of these. What I'm really jazzed up about is Motion Builder, which is an extension of 3DS Max. And what Motion Builder is it allows animators to produce procedural animations. What procedural animations are is that you could do some FK, or you could animate a guy to a point where he's just about to fall, and then what you can do is in Motion Builder is you can use a dynamic simulation to make him hit the floor with ragdoll physics and have him bounce around and whatnot. Then what you can do is you can export that motion data into 3DS Max and use it. ZBrush came onto the scene a couple of years ago and is huge now. It's being used by a lot of studios. Mostly in, you know, in games where you're getting up close to the characters, you know, first-person shooters, that sort of thing. But it's a tremendous tool for producing normal maps. I haven't used Mudbox. Photoshop, as always, it's nice to have good Illustrator chops, produce vector graphics. And Flash is actually something that I've started to look at this week. I think that I think we're going to see a lot more game development in Flash. I think that the Flash paradigm right now is where PC games were at in 1996 in terms of graphical quality. But I think that Flash is going to be more and more of a presence in the future, and I also think it's going to rob bandwidth from PC games themselves. And then for your concept artists out there, there's also Painter. Any questions so far? Yeah?
I'm going to ask you, you said you talk about concept art. Is that a different sort of genre?
Yeah. Actually, you know, I have a wide range of skills, but I'm definitely not a concept artist. But concept artists are, I would categorize them more as your dreamers, you know. And what they do is they plug in with an art director, and the art director will say, hey, you know, we're doing something like maybe a steampunk era shooter or something. And, you know, the characters wear cowboy outfits, you know. And you can give that to a concept artist, and there's a lot of really good concept artists out there that can just bang out work, and they can bang out work iteratively. And they could come back with 7 different looks for this guy. And then you could start to have a dialogue with the concept artist about, well, you know, his head's too small. You know, I'd make his 10-gallon hat bigger. And what's important with them is that they are going to set the tone for how the art is created. And what you really want to do with your concept artist is you want to nail down the look with the concept artist, you know, as soon as possible in the project, so you can use that, you know, as a template for how the art's going to look and how it's going to be produced. And what's really important is that then you got to disseminate that to the team, get them all on the same page in terms of the style of the art. And additionally, you know, you would draft an art style guide that is used in conjunction with the concept art. Everyone reviews those documents. Everyone's on the same page with what the visual goal is. You know,
so. In terms of our students, in terms of career, some of the students in the program, how does someone decide whether they want to be a concept artist or not, or do they have the talent to be one and require more artistic talent? Or how would you explain to students thinking about their careers?
Well, thinking about your careers, like I said, the industry's changed in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. And when I first got into it, there were more generalists. It was more of like, we were more like creative enclaves, you know. And the people starting the studios were really creative individuals. But, you know, in the last 4 years or so, what has happened is that the technological demands on artists are pretty intense. And to remain current on, you know, just what I have listed here is also really demanding. It's tough to be an expert in all of these things. And what you're seeing with studios now and the hiring patterns is that there's more fragmentation to specialists, you know. Some of the specialists that you see that they want a lead technical character animator. They want, a lead rigger. They want someone who does environments. They want an environment artist. So what I would say is that anyone that's drawing or has those kinds of chops and wants to explore being a concept artist, that's what you got to start doing. You got to start creating concept art. Because the thing is that it's all right, if you have a passion for one of these facets that I've just mentioned, it's all right to come out of school, you know, and be a powerhouse in a few of these facets because of, you know, the way that the hiring landscape is right now. It's all right to be a powerhouse in a couple of these facets and just have a working knowledge of the rest. So I would say that, yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, a lot of the bigger studios and the games that have like $40, $60 million budgets are using a lot of great concept artists. Yeah?
You've been lead artist or art director on a bunch of games.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how much of that is management and how much is making art.
Right. Well, the thing was is that I was pretty tight with the president of Tilted Mill. We've worked together a long time. And when I first started, you know, developing into the role of art director, it was important to me that that I also create art. You know, so, you know, I said to him that what I wanted to do was rely a little bit more on the producers to help me with, like, scheduling and milestones and whatnot, so that I wouldn't have to push as much paperwork around. So I managed my team, and I, you know, I handled, you know, personnel disputes. I did the hiring, but I didn't do the day-to-day scheduling. You know, if there was, there would be times where I would get tasks into the pipeline, and it was always up to the producers to prioritize the pipeline because they were ultimately the engines that were running the project. So I would say that, you know, in my last couple of, well, my last couple of years at Tilted Mill, it was about 70% on the management side with 30% on the art production side. And the main reason was is that I love to do it. And I didn't want to be the guy pushing papers, you know. What I really love to do is, I stayed pretty heavily involved in this, is speccing graphic systems. I love to come up with creative ways to solve a problem, and then lay out the specs for how it's going to work, produce the sample art of how it's going to look, and then send that to the programmers, you know, have the dialogue with the programmers how it's going to work. They implement it, and then, you know, we send it to an artist and say, we need 50 more of these. All right, we'll quickly go over the development stages of pre-rendered cinematics. You know, as we mentioned before, there is definitely a movement to doing everything in the engine, or there has been for the last 3 or 4 years. Stage one is going to be conceptualization. This is going to be when you define how the piece is going to look, what is the purpose of the piece. And it's really important, you know, this is your brainstorming concept, you know, facet of the creation. But it's really important to figure out how this piece is going to define the project. How does it fit into the project? So what you need to do is you need to look at the bigger scope of the project and what the designers are trying to accomplish, and then make sure that what you define as the pre-rendered cinematic or the cinematic, you know, it could be a teaser or a trailer or whatever, accurately represents the game. From there, you start to create your shot lists, start to define the piece. What is the length of the piece? If your piece is 2 minutes long, how many shots are there going to be? How many cuts? Generally, what I will do is this is a rough frame outline for, you know, your shot lists. And what I'll do is, this is when I come up with all the file names. This is also an asset list. Shot one is going to be called one, sunrise. Shot two is going to be called shot two, guy on bike. And that's very important in your shot lists, because then later those are going to be the actual assets that you produce. Those are the names of the assets that you produce, so that you can accurately track whether or not you're on schedule. From there, you begin to storyboard the project. I think we all know what storyboards are. And then I like to do something that's called an animated storyboard. What an animated storyboard is, from your shot lists and the timing in your shot lists, you basically build a premiere project, and you know, you scan in your storyboards, and you start to put the storyboards on the screen for how long the shot is defined. So if it's a 3-second shot, you have that panel of the storyboard on the screen for 3 minutes. This is where you first get an idea of the pacing of the piece and whether or not the pacing that you've envisioned is going to work. Hello.
Sorry.
Now, from there, you go to animatics. Animatics are pivotal and key in the development of pre-rendered cinematics. And what they are is, they are rough motion tests. They have no textures. They have no real lighting. But what they are is that you box out your shots from the storyboards. You create very primitive geometry. And what I usually use is just a simple skeleton, and I'll put some basic motion in for the skeleton. And the reason that this is key is that, you know, you don't have the luxury when you're creating cinematics like this of shooting something from 3 different angles and then picking and then editing together the best shots. So everything that's going to end up in the final piece needs to be produced, and you don't want to produce stuff that isn't going to make the cut. So the animatics are going to tell you you know, as an extension of the animated storyboards, the animatics are going to tell you immediately if there's something wrong with the motion or a cut's not going to work, certain camera motions are too fast. In the animatics, you do want to kind of nail down the motion of the cameras, you know, so that you can see how it flows. Now, the other big thing with the animatics, what I would do is when we were working, our sound guys did all of our video editing. So I would send it over to the sound guys. He could start to edit the piece, and the animatics were all named according to the shot list. So I now have 30 files, animatics. I send them over to the sound designer, and he starts to drop them in a timeline in Premiere. Now, the important thing is that from that point forward, the timing does not change. And what this allows is it allows the sound guys to start scoring the piece as well as, you know, figuring out where they're going to put their sound effects and whatnot. From there, you go to your asset list and team assignments. And this is where they start actually producing, you know, the props or the buildings or the sets, that sort of thing. And then from there, you go into your asset production. It's important to note that at this point, you will, through your conceptualization and some test renders, you will have completely figured out the style for the piece, how it's going to look, what kind of color palette you're going to use. Yeah?
So how does this coordinate with maybe different every game?
Yeah.
With the designing of the game, the actual playable part of the game. I mean, assumedly, the assets and so on are all being designed by the overall game design also. I mean, why not? I mean, a naive thought
right.
Would be, why don't you do this last? You know, after the playable part of the game's all done, you'd have all your assets, you know everything, and then you would make these cutscenes.
Typically, you're right. Typically, this, unless you need like a 30-second marketing trailer, right? Because you're going to want to use you don't want to reinvent the wheel. I mean, you're going to want to use the assets that were created for the game. One, so stylistically they match, but two, it's also cheaper. But yeah, you're right. I mean, generally, you know, in my experience and the way that we've always worked is that the cinematic production comes in the last 30% of the project.
Oh, it is less.
Yeah. And what's nice about that is that since it's fluff, you know, if you're pushing hard and then you run into the technical issues in other places in the project, you can chop these down. You know, you should have a plan B all right, we're going to take out the middle segment because it's too labor intensive, or, you know, they're malleable and scalable, you know. From there, you go to your scene assembly, character animation, scene renders, and then, you know, if you have your bigger scenes, you might want to composite them separately, or if you have special effects, you may want to composite them separately, too. Autodesk has some pretty robust video compositing packages. I actually haven't used any of them, but they're supposed to be pretty good. All right, let's talk animation. I made these myself. I'm assuming everyone knows what a mesh is, right? Okay. So a mesh, basically, for in-game art or for something that's pre-rendered, it basically consists of the mesh plus your skeleton equals a game character. The mesh is applied to a game skeleton. I'm going to use a term from Max. It's called a modifier. And what the modifier does is, it basically maps vertices to bones and controls the deformation of the mesh. All of these parameters are exposed and malleable so that you can control creasing of the mesh, or, you know, whether or not you want the vertices to be rigid or, you know, flexible. So this is basically what makes up a character. Now, I'm a big fan of the Max Biped system, and a couple years ago at CDGC, a lot of people were not happy with it. And the reason that I think they're not happy with it is that something you got to understand is that when you're working in a 3D package, and I haven't worked with Maya, but because you can do anything you want, it doesn't mean you can do anything you want. And what happens a lot of times is that people don't use the Max Biped system correctly, and it ends up with them getting a lot of errors and crashes. You need to use these systems because they are so flexible and wide open. You need to use these systems the way they're designed to be used, and you need to use them correctly. Otherwise, you're going to run into problems. Basically, the Max Biped system is a pre-built rig with a built-in IK and FK. We'll get into IK and FK in a minute. And then the mesh that goes on top of that for the character is either going to use a skin modifier or a physique. Autodesk first started out with the physique modifier, which I loved. There's a lot of control in there. I think there's a lot more control than in the skin modifier. But for some reason last year, they inexplicably decided they were going to abandon the physique modifier and phase it out and continue to develop the skin modifier. I find the skin modifier to be a little rudimentary in terms of its controls when compared to the physique modifier. But anyways, that is the modifier that you're going to use to bind the vertices of the mesh to the skeleton or the hierarchy. Now, in addition to that, there's also a modular BIP motion file system. And what that means is that, and this mirrors the way a lot of games work, is that you can have a character and you can load in from a library a collection of motion files. And if you guys have exported anything for games, any characters, you know that you're going to export your figure, and then you're going to export your motion separately. The game at runtime is going to call from a motion library and map these different motions to the character as needed. There are some pretty cool animation systems out there for games, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with them. One's Granny, one's Emotion Effects. I've used both of those. Torque also has its own. But what's cool about Granny, and I'm not sure if Emotion Effects has this yet, is that you can blend animations as they're mapped to the characters. So what you can do is you can export an animation of a guy walking, and then you can export an animation of a guy with his hand up. The game at runtime, the game can actually blend those two things together so that you can get a guy walking with his hand up. You don't actually have to export guy walking, guy with hand up, guy walking with hand up. So you get more iterations. That's pretty cool, the motion blending. All right, inverse kinematics versus forward kinematics. Inverse kinematics. Basically, a kinematic chain is any hierarchy. And what that means is that, it's any hierarchy. It can also be referred to as a rig. But with all IK chains, they have what are called end effectors. End effectors are the key to whether or not it's IK or FK. As you can see at the top, the end effectors are positioned or animated to their desired location, and the translation of the IK chain elements are computed algorithmically. The elements may be assigned specific angle restrictions to retain realism. That's a fancy way of saying that with IK you animate the end effectors, or you can animate really anything in the chain, and the reason that it's inverse kinematics is it's going to affect the translations and the positions of nodes that are above it in the chain. So it's the inverse of the actual hierarchy. Forward kinematics is the computation of the position and orientation of an IK chain's end effector as a function of its joint angles. That's a fancy way of saying wherever you position or rotate the objects in a hierarchy, its end effectors will end up in the resulting position. I don't know. But the thing to remember with IK and FK is that IK, inverse kinematics, you can animate the end effectors. FK is going to be more like a manual positioning. This would be FK if I rotated this arm, rotated that arm, my end effectors are here. IK, my end effectors are here, and I can position them where I want. That's the difference between IK and FK. As an artist, that's all you need to know.
So can something be part of a chain and an end effector too? So like if I wanted to animate a shrug, my shoulders are the end effectors, but normally my fingertips normally the shoulders are part of the chain that ends in my fingertips.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. To clarify, basically the way that IK works is that it needs to have an end effector. It needs to have an end goal, because that's where the IK chain terminates. But you can animate, it's a little tricky in Biped, but you can animate any object in the hierarchy, and it will affect things above it. So you can animate the end effectors, you know, and you can do what's called damping, which it may affect the fingers more than the hand, than the arm, depending on how far you move them. So you may move them a little bit and affect the hand, right? I mean, just the fingers, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that you can also just move the hand if you want to, because it's an IK chain. So it's going to affect what is above it if you're in an IK mode. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right. All right. As animators, these are paramount to animating correctly and animating things that look realistic. These are called animation controllers. I'm not sure what they're called in Maya. You guys may have a different name for them. But basically, the controller is an interface through which predefined presets of parameters are accessed. And this is the part that's key, to control and modify the trajectory of an object through a keyframe. And examples of the controller types include, and you guys are probably familiar with some of these, Bezier, TCB, linear, and noise. We'll get into the specifics of each one, but I like to favor TCB because, I'm really familiar with the interface, and I also feel as though I have more control over it than Bezier. Bezier and TCB are very similar, they're very similar, you know. Tension, continuity, and bias. And I'll show you an example of that. This is an example of a Bezier controller. Now, as you can see, I've created three keyframes for this sphere. You know, there's one at the top, one in the middle, one at the bottom. Now, what is important in what I just said is that you have an interface down here. Your interface is down there. And it is going to control, this spline is the trajectory of your object. And basically what this is going to do is it's going to control the trajectory of and speed of your object through a keyframe. Now if you look at the Bezier, what I've done for you is, Bezier comes in a lot of different flavors. Bezier and TCB, if you're using freeform controllers, they're basically the same. You have just as much control. I again prefer to use TCB. But what you want to think about with these is think about it almost as a 2D spline and how you would draw that spline. And that is going to affect and control how this object moves through that keyframe. Now, the types of TCB control are you have the step controller, you have accelerate into a key, you have decelerate out of the key, and you have freeform. And basically what the freeform is going to do is, if you guys have dealt with 2D graphics where Bezier handles it all, the freeform will allow you to pull out the Bezier handles, and you can modify this trajectory any way that you want, just like you would with any spline. Now, if you pull out your handles, and you can make the spline look something like this, you know, with three freeform keys. But what's important is that the Bezier and the TCB are going to give you organic motion. As you can see here, this is each frame for the animation. But as you can see here, that as this sphere comes into this key here, it's going to be slowing down because the keys are closer together. As it comes out, it's going to speed back up. But what I mean when I say organic motion is that if you're moving your arm and then you move your arm back, it slows down and then it comes back. This is your TCB. You can see that your spline looks a lot the same. Now, instead of having the flyouts to control how the trajectory of the spline is going to look going through certain keys, you're going to you basically have these controls here. TCB, tension, continuity, and bias. And what that's going to do is it's going to affect the tension of the spline, the continuity, whether or not the object moves through the key at a constant rate, and the bias. The bias, what you can do is you can have your tension and continuity happen either before the key or after the key. here's how it looks. I mean, this will give you a good understanding of how TCB works. I mean, as you can see, I cranked up the bias to 50 so that we're having all of the continuity happen on one side of the key. But control is very powerful. A lot of animators don't even break them open, but they are what will make your animations look real. This is linear. I'm not sure there are any controls for. What's that?
About 10 minutes.
Okay, this is linear. I'm not sure there are any controls for linear, but basically what you're going to use for linear, this would be for like robotic or mechanical motions, non-organic animation. You know, you want to move an arm like this. Use your linear controller. All right, let's get into art and what it means to games a little bit. Any questions on controllers?
Just a kind of a question. In terms of like modeling, 3D modeling versus animation, obviously one builds on the other. In the game overall, what relative proportion of the overall effort goes into modeling versus animation? 50-50, 90-10?
It's a tough question. It really depends on the project, you know, because like Naughty Dog did Drake's Fortune, you know, you have one lead character, but he's got 6,000 animations, which I think is overkill. But you know, so they spent a lot of time, you know, doing the animation, and also it feeds into, you know, you can get a lot of data out of like a mocap session. I've never worked with mocap personally. But it's a way to, you know, for a 1 or 2 day session, you can get a lot of data, which is going to decrease the amount of time your artists actually have to spend on it, you know. So I think it really depends on the project. All right, this is a basic color model, and for the purposes of this exercise, I've chosen HSV, hue, saturation, and value. Okay, now if you look at it, a hue is what color you have. The saturation is the strength of that color. And then the brightness and value, which we're going to talk about a lot, and which I think is key to game art, is how light or dark an object is. I mean, sorry, a color is. Today, what we're seeing is, you know, here are your primary colors, your secondary colors, I'm assuming everyone knows this, your tertiary colors. Now, here are a couple different color models. One is called an analogous color palette. The other one is called complementary. And I'm going to show you examples of those in game art in a minute. The analogous color palettes have been huge since, I'd say, the mid-90s in concept art. An analogous color palette, and typically, well, I've seen a lot of concept art that's using the analogous color palette or a monochromatic color palette. But the ones that are using the analogous color palettes are really toning down the saturation. And, you know, I'll show you guys examples of analogous and complementary color palettes. Now, this is where game art started. It's Dali on the left and Fuchs on the right. And these guys were listed as major influences of Geiger. And I think Geiger is probably one of the more influential artists on game art and concept art, you know, probably in the last 20 or 30 years, him and Frazetta. Here's an example of, you know, Geiger's Alien and also a Frazetta piece. Now, you can see that the Frazetta, you know, in addition to, you know, rendering fantasy figures and whatnot, he also tried to incorporate some aspects of, like, classical architecture or classical painting into his pieces. And this is what I'm talking about, how what kind of influence these guys have had on modern-day concept art. You can see their pieces in the upper left. Everything else down here is our contemporary concept artists. And you can see, you know, just, you know, like this here is an analogous color palette, really muted tones. That's something that was big for concept art in the late 90s. You know, you can see the color palette from the Frazetta to the Jason Manley piece here. And, you know, this smacks of Geiger here, too. And, you know, I'm not sure that a lot of concept artists know what kind of influence that Geiger has had on on contemporary concept art. I think that's just the nature. That's the state of the art, and I think that people produce that because it's in vogue. Now, getting back to values and how important I said values are, if you're going to be a concept artist, value studies are really critical. What a value study is it's going to tell you where your forms are and how the forms are going to define the final piece. You got to think about value before you think about color. To know if your composition is going to work. Where value is really important is when you get into 3D games. The values in a 3D game are what are going to make your 3D objects and buildings look more 3D. It's going to pull the forms out of the buildings. And I'll show you what I mean by that. Here it is. It was just a matter of time, right? So this is a screenshot from Fallout. Fallout looks like a great game. Visually, it's a great game. I think it could have been phenomenal if they had pushed the values some. If you look at this and you think about the values that are in it, there's not a lot of range of values. They're going for the post-apocalyptic, cold, gray. You can do that, but you can also push the values to pull some of the forms out of the shapes. I think what really saves Fallout and makes it spectacular is the technology. The Bloom, the HDRI, I mean, all that stuff it's really well put together technically. Now let's look at this as a grayscale component. You'll see that there is not a wide range of values in here. Now what I've done is I kind of hacked in some darker values just to show you what I mean on the bottom. Not sure if you guys could see that, but you know, if you start to pull out, and this is what you think about as you're texturing buildings or figures or anything. If you start to pull some forms out of here, like this sort of thing, you get a lot more depth to the art. And not only that, but it also, when you're in a frenetic environment like this and you're running around, you're moving the camera, it helps the eye organize the shapes. And if you can break down the shapes using values into large blocks, I think it's going to be more appealing to the user, and it's also going to be more immersive, and it's going to be easier to use. So that's something that we always strive to do. Now this to me is beautiful. I think this is one of the best looking games of the last 5 years. Complementary color palette, warms. Now, the accents are dark, you know what I mean? So they really set off our complementary color palette. But check this out in grayscale. You know what I mean? It's well defined. That's what I'm talking about with value and how important value is. If you have strongly saturated colors, you know, complementary colors, you're going to want to use values in the similar range, but then you use darker values to accent and to pull out different shapes and objects, you know, in your pieces. This was a piece that I did. It was a 3D Max render that I painted into. And it's something to think about when you're doing, 3D characters, if you want to do things that look more organic, consider where your character comes from, what's his personality, what does he eat, where does he live, how does he work. I thought about all that stuff for this. This is from a story called The Reanimator, and I didn't want to just do the mad scientist thing. I wanted to catch this guy in a moment where he's vulnerable. Yeah, 2 minutes? I think I got 2 slides left. So, but the thing is that you know with this 3D model, and it's something to think about. Like a lot of people starting out, what they do is they make perfectly symmetrical 3D models because they're kind of wrapped up in the fact that, ooh, look at this model, it's nice and smooth. What I did with this guy is I forced a wide angle lens, I tilted the camera axis, I scaled his head about 110%, 120% the size of a normal human, to start to give him some feeling that this is a handcrafted piece and not a sterile 3D render. And you know, there's a lot more to this piece that I could go into, but I'll move on. SimCity's societies and destinations I would just like to talk about for a second. This was this is my pride and joy. It's one of the most complex games that I've ever worked on. This game had it all. We built a proprietary engine. We shipped the initial one in 12 months. Every building had 5 textures, ambient occlusion, diffuse, specular, emissive, the whole 9 yards. And just to give you some stats on it, in 18 months we made 700 buildings. Every building had five textures per building with two texture variants. Five environments where the user could enter different environments. 18 different sky textures and 25 different sets of lighting data. 80 vehicles and 100 figures. 200 contextual and operational props. That would be dependent on how you built your city. You would get different props appearing on the buildings. If it was Fun City, you'd get balloons. If it was an Orwellian authoritarian city, you would get, you know, security cameras. So in all, we created, in 18 months, over 4,000 graphical assets. And this was, I don't know, man. I think that this project should be looked at for some technical prowess. And I'm really proud of it. Didn't sell that well, though. That's it. Thank you. I was born in Middletown, New York.
Do you ever use Poser, or is that elementary compared to the other schools?
What's that?
Poser. It was a package I used.
Yeah, you know, I used it when it first came out. I used it for the Mac, you know, and then, it didn't, when I first migrated into 3D, like, Poser was really rudimentary at that point, and so now I have everything I need, like, in Macs, so I've never gone back to it. But I have to tell you that I'm not sure how some of the Poser renders are done, but they're getting some really nice renders out of Poser in terms of, like, making skin look soft and, like, nice organic soft renders. And I'm not sure if they're rendering it with third-party software, if that's the renderer from Poser. What's that? Right. I started messing around with Mudbox, and ZBrush, and I'm really impressed with that. I mean, it's approachable and easy to use, and you can get some really, really cool looking stuff out of it.
You start working with a team of artists, say artists who are fairly recently out of school. What would you want them to care about? What would you want to be floating around at the top of their mind? I don't mean what skills, what technologies they apply necessarily, or take that for granted, but what do you want them to be into?
You mean professionally, or
I mean
as they come into the studio?
Making visual images with a training in it. What do you want them to do? What would be cool? What would be attractive to you in the background?
Well, the first and foremost, it goes back to, like, craftsmanship. I mean, I'd like to see, when I'm reviewing portfolios and whatnot, I'd like to see, you know, pieces that are well thought out, and, you know, 3D renders that look good, and there shouldn't be anything in the portfolio that's marginal. You know, professionally, when they come into the studio, and I've tried this with a lot of junior artists, is that you need to understand what we're trying to achieve, you know. And just because you're working on shrubs or bushes, it doesn't mean that's no excuse for not knowing the design documentation inside and out, you know. I don't think so. I think it's just a passion for art, you know, and for game art, you know. What I do is I study game art because I love it, you know. And I think that to survive in this business, that you need to come in and be passionate. And I think you need to be passionate not only about the art but also about the technology. And you mentioned Hopper, that he did one of my favorite paintings of all time. Main Street. I was actually going to use it because it is, to me, it's the top of the heap in terms of an example of how you make art. It's gorgeous, you know what I mean? And everything is done right. He's pulled the forms out of the painting. He's got a great color palette going. I mean, it's a beautiful painting. Thanks.